On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Lately, it's easy to assume that Al-Qaeda is hardly what it was, that since its massive attack on September 11th, it's been beleaguered, aching for solid leadership and struggling wildly to regroup. And in tandem with the war on terror in the geopolitical background. But new reports suggest otherwise, that Al-Qaeda is back. This hour, On Point, Al-Qaeda on the rise and America's response. Joining me this hour to talk about Al-Qaeda and our two terrorism experts, Georgetown University's Bruce Hoffman and Boston University Professor Hussein Haqqani. Welcome to you both.
Pleasure being here.
Hello.
First, I want to turn to Washington, where New York Times national security correspondent Mark Mazzetti joins us. His front page article yesterday, which he co-wrote with David Rode, is called Al-Qaeda Chiefs Are Seen to Regain Power. Mark, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us first, how organized, how powerful has Al-Qaeda become?
The assessment among intelligence and counterterrorism officials in Washington is that the senior Al-Qaeda leadership is steadily becoming more in control of the network that they built. There was belief that in the couple years after September 11th, the senior leaders such as bin Laden, Zawahiri, were on the run, kind of disconnected from their foot soldiers around the globe, and in part because they were hiding, they were fearing for their lives. But gradually over the last year, they have established a kind of command network akin to what they had before September 11th, although no one believes that it is at that level or that their infrastructure is as mature as it was before September 11th in Afghanistan.
You also report that the new Al-Qaeda operations hub, if you will, is in a mountainous Pakistani tribal area of North Waziristan. Can you describe what that area is like?
It's, I guess if you're a terrorist leader, probably one of the safest places to hide. It's a mountainous region, extremely remote, very difficult to get to. It's right along the border with Afghanistan in the western part of Pakistan. And it's this whole region we've been hearing for many years that Al-Qaeda leaders fled to after the attacks into Afghanistan after September 11th, the U.S.-led war in Afghanistan. And so it's a region that has a population that in some ways is sympathetic to Al-Qaeda leadership. They've put a lot of money there. And so it's a good place to hide.
How much of a role is Osama bin Laden playing in this particular area? Is he perhaps commanding the network from there?
It's difficult to assess. Well, first of all, we should state up front that no one in Washington still has an idea where he is or where Zawahiri is. They don't know for sure. They believe he is in this region. And the assessment in Washington is that he's plays an inspirational role and that he is in charge, but he doesn't direct day-to-day operations, much the same way that he didn't direct day-to-day operations before the September 11th attacks. He leaves that to some of his lieutenants. But certainly, make no mistake, he is trying to build up a kind of operations hub in that region.
Talk about the compounds that you reported on yesterday, Mark. What kind of compounds are there in this region, Waziristan? How sophisticated are they? How many are they training there?
The belief among intelligence officials is that these are relatively small compounds dotted around the mountainous border region, training 10 to 20 people at a time. It's not what I think people picture the Al-Qaeda camps were before September 11th in Afghanistan, very sort of mature operations, people doing shooting ranges on jungle gyms, all that stuff. We've seen the footage. These are smaller operations, less sophisticated. But I think the concern is that gradually they're becoming more mature and that these camps are plugged into a wider network that are plotting attacks against Western targets.
So just to be clear, they're not rebuilding or expanding existing camps. These are new camps being set up.
Yes, they're new camps, and to some extent, I think the belief is that they're merging with regional and local militant camps. In other words, Al-Qaeda operatives who are planning global attacks in some ways are working hand-in-hand with Pakistani militants who might be working to overthrow the Musharraf government, with people who are looking to attack into Afghanistan to undermine Karzai's government. So there's, it's really getting increasingly difficult to distinguish who is whom.
You also report a particular concern is that these camps are being frequented by British citizens. How so?
Well, the concern is that the British Pakistani population, which is quite large, we know, that several members have been traveling to Pakistan, perhaps to get some of this training. There are linkages between not only the 2005 London bombings, but also, officials believe, linkages with the last summer, the failed plot to blow up transatlantic flights, that there are linkages between those and camps in Pakistan. And so the real concern, both in Washington and in London, is that this British citizens of Pakistani descent who have British travel documents, it's very easy for them to travel around the world, perhaps to carry out these types of attacks.
What's been the response, Mark, from Washington, from the Bush administration, about the possibility of a military response, that sort of thing?
Well, I think officials are torn. One of the biggest dilemmas in Washington since September 11th is how do you push the Pakistan government to do more, quote unquote, to dismantle these networks without undermining and perhaps toppling the Pakistani government of Musharraf. Musharraf is an ally, Washington believes, and the fear is that if Musharraf were to go, whether possibly a radical government could take over, and that would be far worse. So they're split over what to do, and I think some are advocating direct strikes against the camps led by U.S. troops or, you know, airstrikes, but there's always the possibility of civilian casualties. There's the fear that any kind of direct action would only further weaken Musharraf's position.
Mark Mazzetti from The New York Times. Hold on just a moment. Let me bring in Bruce Hoffman, a professor at Georgetown University, senior fellow at West Point's Combating Terrorism Center. Bruce, nice to have you again.
Same here.
Would you say Al-Qaeda is not just reorganizing but flourishing?
Well, I'm not sure I would go so far as to say it's flourishing. I would say that it's certainly resurrected itself, and it's certainly reaching out or stretching to continue to not only carry out terrorist attacks, but to implement that spectacular type of attack, such as they released a number of individuals in the United Kingdom plotted to do this summer with simultaneous attacks on American airliners, is a means to catapult them back into the limelight. But the point is they haven't gone away, and they are reorganizing and regrouping.
In an op-ed piece in the Los Angeles Times today, you say, quote, Al-Qaeda's stunning resurrection begs the question of how the most powerful country in the world can launch a six-year, no-holds-barred global war on terrorism at great cost to its pocketbook and international standing, only to find the main target of these Herculean efforts still alive and kicking. Should we assume that our efforts against Al-Qaeda are a failure?
Well, no, I wouldn't say that they've been a failure. I think they were very successful between the period of October 2001, when Operation Enduring Freedom commenced in Afghanistan, well into 2003. I think what's happened in the past 3 years or 4 years, as our attention has been distracted and then in turn preoccupied with Iraq, we've taken our eye off the ball. And while we've taken our eye off the ball, we see a burgeoning insurgency in southern Afghanistan that did not exist 2 or 3 years ago, and we also now see a revitalized Al-Qaeda.
So Iraq blinded us to an Al-Qaeda resurgence.
Well, it's difficult not to draw that conclusion, but I think it's more pernicious than that. It not only blinded us, but also I think as the situation in Iraq deteriorated for too long, we still sought to console ourselves with the belief, well, things may be bad in Iraq, but we've beaten Al-Qaeda. The problem is that as things were worsening in Iraq, Al-Qaeda was also, as I wrote, under our noses, basically across the border, regrouping and reorganizing to carry on a struggle that, after all, they declared more than 10 years ago. They are in this for the long haul. Of that, there's no doubt. And they're, I think, far more resilient and certainly far more formidable than we perhaps initially imagined 5 or 6 years ago.
Mark Mazzetti, New York Times, has that been your reporting, from your understanding from your reporting, that during the Iraq war, Al-Qaeda has been able to adapt and adjust to our efforts?
That's right, and I would actually add one further point. There is a belief in the intelligence community that the war in Iraq has helped inspire a new generation of militants and people who might align themselves to al-Qaeda. The last April National Intelligence Assessment about Global Terrorism said that the Iraq Jihad is shaping a new generation of terrorist leaders and operatives, and that the Iraq conflict had become a, quote, cause celeb for jihadist. So you've got that dynamic working as well.
You also reported yesterday that al-Qaeda along those lines has shown an increased international capacity in places like Algeria, for example.
That's right. The belief among officials is that the network is gradually expanding its overseas networks. And one example would be in North Africa, where a group known as the GSPC, and they're an Algerian terrorist organization that has long been had the goal of overthrowing the Algerian government, in fact has now aligned itself with al-Qaeda with the view of carrying out operations across North Africa. Officially, that they changed their name last fall, and they're now called al-Qaeda of the Islamic Maghreb.
I want to turn now first to Washington, where we're joined by Pakistan's ambassador to the United States, Mahmoud Durrani. Ambassador Durrani, it's nice to have you.
Hello, Jane. It's a pleasure to be with you on this program.
Thank you. What is your response, sir, to the reports of a resurgence of al-Qaeda in Pakistan?
I think the focus seems to be getting too narrow. I think there's a resurgence, yes, and it is because of the conditions in Afghanistan. I think President Bush brought that out. He laid out a five-point agenda. Pakistan is a small part of the problem. The bigger part of the problem is Afghanistan. You don't resolve Afghanistan, you'll never beat al-Qaeda. And the main element in this is coordination by Pakistan, Afghanistan, and the U.S.
But al-Qaeda seems to be setting up their operations, their base of operations, or at least the heart of them in Pakistan. So why, after 6 years, after these many years, there still seems to be a problem shutting down al-Qaeda within Pakistan? Why is that?
You see, this is the whole problem. You've got a wrong focus. The problem is not in Pakistan. It is not in the heart. It's the failure of counter-terrorist operations in Afghanistan. Afghanistan is many, many times larger than that portion of Pakistan that we are blamed, and the problem is not there. I think there is a wrong focus. You have to sort out Afghanistan, which is a far bigger area where the al-Qaeda, the Taliban hide and operate.
Well, what is Pakistan's responsibility then, sir, in getting rid of al-Qaeda within its country?
Pakistan's responsibility is not only for U.S. or anybody. It is responsibility for Pakistan itself. Al-Qaeda, terrorism of any kind, is against our national interest. We want to destroy it for our own sake. So that is a national responsibility. And the perception that everything is happening in Pakistan is totally false and wrong and an exaggeration.
There are reports that President Musharraf in Pakistan negotiated a treaty with tribal areas in the area of North Waziristan, where we're hearing that al-Qaeda is having its resurgence, and that treaty was essentially a failure. What was that treaty, and what was accomplished by it?
You see, this is the whole sad part, because there are some analysts who sit here and pontificate. The tribal area, it is a treaty in an old tradition, and I can tell you today that sooner or later you have to do this in Afghanistan, because you have to separate the bad guys from the good guys. This is what we have done. We have separated the bad guys from the good guys. North Waziristan, it is in only one tribal area, in a very small segment. And in that, we have far greater peace there. And we are trying to, after the treaty, we have hit bases twice. So we are against and we are fighting them. And there's a level of coordination between your intelligence and our intelligence, and all the operations that we conduct there, you are involved. I mean, the U.S. intelligence is involved. So we are fighting them wherever we find them. But to say that a treaty is a cause of this is totally incorrect, because I know people started saying this from the moment we signed this treaty. But I think they will realize that sooner or later we'll have to do this. In fact, President Karzai is the one who mentioned during a meeting between Karzai, President Musharraf, and President Bush that we should use the tribal leaders to sort out this problem. So at one level, we want to do it. We are talking of a grand jirga between Pakistan and Afghanistan, and we say we should not do this. This is incorrect.
Mahmoud Durrani, Ambassador to the United States from Pakistan. We appreciate your time. He joins us from Washington. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
With me now in studio is Hussein Haqqani, Director of the Center for International Relations at Boston University. He's been a journalist, a diplomat, and an advisor to three Pakistani prime ministers, including Benazir Bhutto. He contributes to numerous publications, including the Wall Street Journal, the Financial Times, and is the author of Pakistan, Between Mosque and Military. Nice to have you. Thank you, Mr. Haqqani.
Pleasure being here, Jane.
What do you make of the ambassador's response just now, essentially laying the blame for all of this on Afghanistan?
The one point that the ambassador made, which is valid, is that terrorism is as much a concern for Pakistan as it is for the United States. And I can understand the ambassador's frustration with the feeling, which many Pakistanis also feel, by the way. Pakistani Americans come to me and say, there's just too much criticism of Pakistan. So I can relate to that. I can understand that. That said, I don't think that it is fair to characterize this as an Afghan problem or a Pakistan problem. This is rooted in the history of Islamist militancy in that region. Pakistan allowed itself to be the staging ground for the war against the Soviets during the 1980s, during which all kinds of Islamist militants congregated in Pakistan. And now the Pakistani state is finding tremendous difficulty in being able to finish off a business that had started about 20 years ago. In the tribal areas, people say, 20 years ago, you came to us and said, these are good guys, these are mujahideen, help them. We married our daughters to them. They are now our relatives. They've been living amongst us for 20 years, people who are now with Osama bin Laden. Now you say they are terrorists. How can we change on a dime? It's not easy. And so those are the difficulties that Pakistan faces. And Afghanistan, of course, has just come out of Taliban rule. It's a very weak state.
So given that history then, sir, what is the official policy toward al-Qaeda in Pakistan? If the government really wanted to crack down on al-Qaeda, could they root them out?
Yes and no. The Pakistani state has to get out of a lot of things that it's squandering its energies on. For example, General Musharraf is fighting tribal rebellion in Balochistan. He's fighting al-Qaeda. He's fighting his own political opponents. He's fighting, he still wants to retain some leverage against India. Now, when you have so many balls in the air, some ball will fall. And it seems to me that the ball that keeps falling is the ball of containing al-Qaeda and its allies.
How long can al-Qaeda maintain operations, if not flourish, in Pakistan? And what does that mean for the long term for U.S.-Pakistani relations?
Well, before I say something about U.S.-Pakistani relations, let me say that the Bush administration dropped the ball after 9/11 when it decided only to degrade but not to eliminate al-Qaeda. So what happened was that the Taliban were not finished off, al-Qaeda was not finished off, and now they have just been able to reconstitute themselves and have become a serious and a bigger problem. Pakistan's role has been, of course, that of a degrader, which helped in the beginning. But because Pakistan has not yet gone down to the roots of the problem within Pakistan, militant groups still operate in Pakistan. The linkages between various state agencies and militant groups were not completely eliminated. We're talking about 150 million people in Pakistan, Jane.
Let me ask Bruce Hoffman again from Georgetown University, senior fellow at West Point. Is there an honest recognition, Mr. Hoffman, of al-Qaeda's resurgence in Washington?
I think now there is, and we saw this last month very clearly when Director of National Intelligence, Ambassador John Negroponte, in his annual assessment that was presented to the Senate Select Intelligence Committee.
And what really did he say? What did Mr. Negroponte say?
Well, in very much of a reversal from previous administration and White House statements that al-Qaeda was on the run, that it was a defeated organization and so on, Ambassador Negroponte, I think in a stunning reversal, said that al-Qaeda was not only quote-unquote resilient, but very much identified these camps in Pakistan as one of the main reasons and problems accounting for al-Qaeda's resurgence, and arguing that this resurgence had implications in North Africa, in the Middle East, in Europe, and especially in the United Kingdom.
Mark Mazzetti, is Pakistan both the problem and the solution to the terror threat against the United States?
I think that's the feeling in Washington that Pakistan has been a very loyal ally to the Bush administration since September 11th. At the same time, all the constraints that Mr. Haqqani talked about are there in terms of what Pakistan can do against al-Qaeda. And that consequently has led to a frustration among many, some in the Pentagon, some in the White House, about the fact that the Pakistani government has allowed al-Qaeda to regroup. So I think you've got this feeling that it is both a friend and an enemy in this war against al-Qaeda.
I want to listen for a moment to President Bush, who was speaking last week at the conservative think tank, the American Institute, and we'll talk about it in a moment.
The snow is going to melt in the Hindu Kush Mountains, and when it does, we can expect fierce fighting to continue. Taliban and al-Qaeda are preparing to launch new attacks. Our strategy is not to be on the defense, but to go on the offense.
Mark Mazzetti, New York Times, you read this speech. What did you make of it? Did you notice a change in President Bush in terms of the war on terror and al-Qaeda?
Yeah, I think from that speech, it was interesting. While he did talk about the successes of the United States in you know, wiping out the Taliban in Afghanistan over the last few years and hitting al-Qaeda, there was a much more sober tone in terms of what remains of al-Qaeda, their strengths, and also their ability to carry out attacks both in Afghanistan and elsewhere. And, it, you know, if you look back just a few months ago when President Bush talked about this right before the elections in November, said al-Qaeda is on the run, we're winning, there was not a whole lot of that in the speech last week.
Hmm. Bruce Hoffman, you say in the Los Angeles Times today, your op-ed piece, quote, al-Qaeda cannot be defeated by military means alone because it relies on propaganda and radicalization. How does that figure now then into U.S. strategy going forward?
I think that, you know, military force clearly has an enormously important role to play in defeating al-Qaeda, so I don't want to say that it's not absolutely central. But I think the problem that we've seen is that kinetics, as the U.S. military would say, the use of force, essentially just addresses the most immediate threat in front of you. It doesn't do anything to sever an organization's ability to continue to recruit and attract sympathizers and supporters. So critically, I think, as an overall strategy, we have to have one that relies on kinetics in neutralizing the clearest, most imminent threats against us, but also is one that's forward-looking enough that is seeking through, for want of a better term or for shorthand, a hearts and minds campaign that is designed specifically to counter the resonance of al-Qaeda's message, and that reaches out not just to the next generation of terrorists, because, in fact, we've already lost them. They've already been indoctrinated. They've already been radicalized. They're being trained now in these camps, but that reaches out to the generation beyond the next, to the children that are growing up throughout North Africa, the Middle East, South Asia, who are susceptible to these heady currents of radicalization. And if we don't reach them, we will ensure that we're fighting this struggle for generations and decades hence.
I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. Let's go to the phones. Seth is calling from New Haven, Connecticut. Seth, hello. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm a big fan of your show and your guest, Hussein Haqqani. I work to engage the American public on these issues, and one of the difficulties that we have is if you say al-Qaeda is resurging, there's a fear that grasps people. And the way that they respond is generally to think you have to project power. And we just heard from your guest, Bruce Hoffman, we really need a hearts and minds campaign. How do we engage the American people on this while putting the fear out there, but in a way that people understand we can't just look for immediate results through security? We have to look for a much broader effort. What are some ways that we can frame these issues that convey that message? Because my own concern is that all of these fears are going to actually play back into some of the policies that have misguided us so far.
Bruce Hoffman, good question, Seth. Thank you. Bruce Hoffman, how do we engage Americans in a different way?
Right. I think Seth's point's a very good one. Part of this, I think, is disentangling America's sense of national security from the threat of terrorism. What worries me is that we, especially in the post-9/11 Commission era, is that we've equated national security with somehow hermetically sealing the United States off from any potential terrorist attack. And what worries me is that in the event an attack is successful, even a minor one, from al-Qaeda in the United States, we'll completely panic and overreact, which is precisely what terrorists want us to do. So in that sense, I think our leaders have to be much more forthright in firstly, not just talking about this somewhat belatedly now as the long war, but also suggesting that terrorism is a fact of life in the 21st century. Mm. We're not going to stop all of them, but we are doing our best to stop some of them, and that terrorism is a threat that we have that in essence has to be constantly and persistently countered. It's not a war that can be won by defeating an enemy on a conventional battlefield.
Mm. Hussein Haqqani, your thoughts?
Well, what makes an Islamist militant is hatred. And that hatred drives their desire to become terrorists. So I think to think of it only in terms of liquidating the terrorists we know is not enough, because locating them before liquidating them is equally important. And you can't locate terrorists as long as they swim like fish in friendly waters. That's what's happening in Pakistan's tribal areas. That's what's happening in eastern and southern Afghanistan. These are disgruntled people, angry, and they blame the United States for their conditions. Unless and until the United States and the American people can understand that there is a political dimension to this, that this is not just about, hey, there are these guys out there, we just need to find them and drop bombs on them. We also need to stop their recruitment. Al-Qaeda runs websites. There are documents that come out of Al-Qaeda. There's a whole debate going on about its political objectives. Iraq has become a recruitment poster. There was no Al-Qaeda in Iraq before 9/11. Now Al-Qaeda says, we can kill more Americans in Afghanistan and in Iraq. Why have we created political circumstances that enable Al-Qaeda to expand its recruitment? And how can we intercept the young recruits from becoming trained terrorists? I think it's a three-part process Americans need to understand. First, we have to deal with the hatred that drives people into becoming recruited as militants. Second, we have to find people who are being receptive to these messages and are therefore looking for training so that they can act on their anger. And last, we have to find people who are already trained and set to go, and these are the only people that we need to focus on and eliminate militarily.
You have mentioned that Al-Qaeda actually has journals that they keep. What kind of journals are they? What's in them?
Well, let me begin by saying that, above all, Al-Qaeda sees itself as an ideological movement, and therefore it sees itself as being engaged in a millennial struggle to overthrow the domination of what they see as unbelief over Muslims. So propaganda and recruitment are very important. For this, of course, there are websites, there are magazines, there are journals, there are publications online, not your routine publication that you can send a subscription to with a credit card. But through this, they basically want to recruit more people and make the militants who are already in their camps more motivated. And so you find online biographies of martyrs, their life stories. You find ideological debate sometimes. Did we do the right thing by attacking the United States? Did we have a religious or theological or ideological justification for the 9/11 attacks? All of this exists, and this literature basically shows that this is a movement of ideas more than it's a movement of just of operations. The American view, or the general American view, that these are just a bunch of people sitting in a cave plotting and planning to destroy America or hurt America and therefore can be taken out very easily, is an imperfect view. It is a movement that thrives on recruiting new and younger people into its ranks.
So it's a movement of ideas. So when you read them, it's not chilling. It's not something that you find frightening or difficult to take.
Well, I find some of it chilling, of course, especially when they talk about human life in a very demeaning manner. For them, a sort of sacrificial killing of individuals is pretty acceptable, which it isn't to me, and surely to anybody with a humane bone in their body. That said, it is to be seen as an ideological movement. After all, in the battle against communism, Americans were able to read communist literature, see the various debates taking place amongst various Marxist movements, make distinctions between and amongst them, and understand their future intentions. Mm. I think the same needs to be done about Al-Qaeda.
Let's take another call from Nashville, Tennessee. This one, Tom, is on the line. Tom, hello. Welcome.
Yes. Greeting, Jane and guests. When I was in seminary, I read a statement attributed to Karl Barth, and the statement was to this effect, that you should never stare the devil in the face, but occasionally give him a sideways glance. And what we've done with Al-Qaeda, as well as with his Saddam Hussein is we have demonized him. We have stared him in the face. And as a result, you know, we have made them more important than they are. So, you know, my comment is that I want to echo what Bruce Hoffman said about not trying to beat all these enemies with military force, but using a hearts and mind campaign. But we don't even need to do this fantastical war on terror, spend all this time and effort and money trying to create a new justification for militarists. What we need to do is we need to calm down. We need to stop considering Al-Qaeda as a tremendous challenge to our values.
Well, let me take that point to Mark Mazzetti. Mark, have we made Al-Qaeda more important than they are, do you think?
Well, I think that there would be, you know, most people I speak to in Washington would say that, you know, it would be hard to ignore what Al-Qaeda has done or to not respond to Al-Qaeda attacks around the globe. I mean, most specifically the September 11th attacks. I think that there was little debate here that the Al-Qaeda infrastructure as it was in Afghanistan needed to be destroyed because they were plotting for future attacks and Afghanistan had become a safe haven. I think where the caller does have a point and where people would agree with him is that you cannot just do this with military force. There is on one hand, you can take out Al-Qaeda leaders, but you have to do far more and the far more difficult work of what Bruce was talking about, the Hearts and Minds campaign, reconstruction, somehow disassociating large populations with militant leaders. And that's much harder and ultimately more important, I think, than just kind of the military strikes that were done retard the growth of Al-Qaeda.
Let's go to Medford, Massachusetts. Tom is on the line from there. Tom, hello.
Hi, Jane. Well, all I want to say is that the American people and certainly our administration bear a terrific responsibility for the resurgence of Al-Qaeda because we took our eyes off the ball when we went into a totally irrelevant conflict in Iraq. A conflict that we have lost, that was absolutely unnecessary, that Iraq had nothing to do with the terrorism that was exercised on 9/11, and we failed in Afghanistan, and we failed diplomatically in Pakistan, and got into this quagmire in Iraq.
Let me turn to Bruce Hoffman. You essentially addressed this today in your op-ed piece in the Los Angeles Times, Bruce. Agreed.
Becoming enmeshed in Iraq and then becoming entangled in Iraq is precisely what Al-Qaeda has always wanted. Even before the actual invasion in March 2003, in January and February, over these same internet sites and online magazines that Professor Haqqani has very accurately described, Al-Qaeda was actively soliciting people to come fight in Iraq, not to prop up Saddam Hussein, but to engage the United States. And I think even our attitude on Al-Qaeda and Iraq shows a fundamental misreading of our enemy. In many instances, I think that leaving Iraq would not necessarily validate exactly what the terrorists want. I think that from Al-Qaeda's point of view, they want us to stay engaged in Iraq. Our involvement in Iraq, I believe, bought bin Laden and Zawahiri precisely the breathing space they needed at a critical time when they were indeed on the run, when they were on the ropes. And they see Iraq now as consuming American manpower and treasure and enabling them to rebuild and reorganize in the camps along the Afghani border.
Mark Mazzetti from the New York Times, you actually reported yesterday that men were receiving training in Pakistan and had been sent to Iraq from Al-Qaeda. I wanted to actually ask you, I know you have to go here for a moment, but in a moment, when most people hear that Al-Qaeda is regrouping, as you have been reporting, they wonder if that means there's a greater threat of an attack here in the United States. What do you think? Do you think that's true?
There's worry among people I talk to that not that there's going to be attack tomorrow, but that any time Al-Qaeda leaders and planners have the ability to plan and as opposed to you know, run for their lives from either Pakistani or U.S. military or counterterrorism officials, then there's the greater likelihood that they could successfully carry out an attack. The networks that have been built over the last few years do concern people in terms of people being able to be not only trained in Pakistan, but then return to Western countries and do further plotting on their own or carry out plots that were hatched in Pakistan. So not to be alarmist, because no one is saying I think that they expect an imminent attack tomorrow or the next week or the next month, but there's rising concern that that could be a possibility in the future.
And then generally speaking, then, based on your reporting, this resurgence, how big of a setback is it generally to American efforts against al-Qaeda?
It's considered a big setback, and if you look at it from the point of view, is after September 11th, this was determined to be the number one target for the United States, was dismantling the al-Qaeda infrastructure, killing or capturing senior leaders. That's happened to some extent, but if you believe that al-Qaeda is indeed resurgent and is reconstructing its network, then that's a pretty large setback.
Mark Mazzetti, national security correspondent for The New York Times. His recent article in the paper with reporter David Rode is Al-Qaeda chiefs are seen to regain power. I know you have to run, Mark Mazzetti. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Let's go back to the phones. Jay is calling from Waltham, Massachusetts. Jay, hello. You're on the air.
Thank you, Jane. I'll make my question quick because I know you're pushing the top of the hour. I know that the battle for hearts and minds is going to be very important. I kind of want to see the Gandhi or the Martin Luther King arise out of all this, in a sense. But what I was interested in knowing is whether there's any battle for hearts and minds kind of activity going on in Washington or other capitals that's spooling up in some way that we might know more about. And if so, what is it and what can we learn?
Thank you, Jay. Hussein Haqqani, you're shaking your head.
Well, all I'm saying is that while there's been a lot of talk about a battle for hearts and minds, the Bush administration's policy has primarily focused on military means. The problem has been, for example, that al-Qaeda sees Iraq as an opportunity to get its troops, its foot soldiers, battle-hardened, just as the war against the Soviets trained the first generation of al-Qaeda. And the United States and its allies have virtually abdicated all responsibility or any serious role in the battle for hearts and minds, even though everybody occasionally talks about it.
Shahid is calling from Toronto, Canada. Shahid, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
I went to school in Peshawar. I studied in Peshawar University and all the other places, and I've studied at Cornell and Oxford. And every time I return to Pakistan, I'm deeply disappointed. And recently, I traveled through the areas you're talking about because I have a lot of friends who went to university with me abroad who are intricately linked to the prominent families in those areas. The distinction that I can draw is very stark and grave. And that is that unless and until we make a concerted effort in those areas to make and provide infrastructure that was promised during the Afghan war with the Russians, and when the Americans just got up and left, the Pakistanis settled with about 5 million refugees who the only livelihood they had was smuggling goods and bringing arms into the country. There was a time when I left Pakistan, nobody was allowed to own a firearm. 5 years later, when I returned from Oxford, everybody had firearms on the street. Problem is today that unless and until America begins to support the people of Pakistan and give them genuine, sincere help building infrastructure, educational institutions that have been deprived funding because of excessive use of national wealth and revenue by the army, which is taking almost 45-50% of GND of the national growth each year. Even if they have 8% growth this year, it isn't going to the people, where the cost of living has escalated about 600%.
We hear you. The displaced and the disillusioned of Pakistan. Thank you for your call, Shahid. Let me turn back to Bruce Hoffman to go back to the issue of Pakistan for a moment. I know it's a sensitive issue and one you've written about, Professor Hoffman. How to address Pakistan's role as a haven for militants without undermining the government of Musharraf itself?
Well, I think this is one of the fundamental diplomatic challenges of our time that's really on par with the negotiations that have been ongoing with North Korea recently, certainly with the threat of a nuclear Iran. Pakistan is yet another issue. And here, I think we, you know, at the same time, we have to acknowledge that I think the Bush administration, right after 9/11, one of the most significant policy victories or achievements of the administration was getting President Musharraf and Pakistan not only on our side in the war on terrorism, but also ensuring control over Pakistan's nuclear arsenal by doing so. So this is very important in why our diplomacy has to be so delicate, not least because, as we heard earlier, Pakistan is both the problem, but it's also the solution. Many of the significant al-Qaeda plots and attacks directed both against the United States, both this past summer, but also in 2004, and against the United Kingdom, both in 2004 and 2005, were broken up because of information given to British and American authorities by their Pakistani counterparts. So it's not that Pakistan isn't cooperating. I think it's like it's just as the previous caller said, his remarks about the complexity of the political situation in Pakistan and the growth of the army, but also, I think, especially the growth of these militant organizations that are backstopping and providing the training camps and providing the weapons, perhaps, and even some of the instruction that al-Qaeda lost in Afghanistan has been absolutely pivotal.
Hussein Haqqani, I'll give you the last word on this. How significant is the pressure on President Musharraf to do something about this?
Well, there's a lot of pressure on General Musharraf, but let me just say that U.S. diplomacy should not be centered on an individual. General Musharraf is an important ally, but he's an individual. The important thing is to think about Pakistan in the bigger picture. The United States gives Pakistan $1.4 billion to buy F-16 aircraft from U.S. companies, but gives only $190 million for its $150 million people's education uplift. I think that needs to be changed. I think we need to start looking beyond General Musharraf the individual, however good he may have been for the U.S. in certain areas, and we need to look at Pakistan as a flawed state that needs to be brought back from the brink and developed as a stable, moderate nation, which the people of Pakistan, as the previous caller rightly pointed out, would like it to be.
Last thought to sort of wrap up our hour, Bruce Hoffman and Hussein Haqqani. If we were to revisit this subject a year from now, do you think the resurgence is going to flourish further, or do you think that there will be some sort of crackdown or some sort of effort to harness it? Bruce Hoffman, you first.
At the moment, I think it's absolutely imperative to reverse it, but it's going to prove very difficult. The United States, of course, is constrained from taking unilateral action across the border in Pakistan. So it's really going to depend on, I think, a significant change in the policies of the Musharraf government that acknowledges they are doing quite a bit, but that they will have to do more.
Hussein Haqqani?
Terrorism is a multi-headed hydra, and I think that it needs a multi-headed approach. I think it's unfortunate that we have focused on only specific geographic areas and specific aspects of the problem. Unless and until it's seen in its totality, it will continue to be a problem for the United States and for the world.
Hussein Haqqani from Boston University, Bruce Hoffman from Georgetown University in Washington, thank you very much for being with us.
You're very welcome.
Mark Mazzetti, also from the New York Times, and Pakistani Ambassador to the United States, Mahmoud Durrani, also were with us. Thank you as well. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. Thank you for joining us.